Dublin's Pride celebrations have been well underway since the start of the month, but as Pride Parade is set to take place on the streets of the capital on Saturday, we think it's an opportunity here to look at what Pride really is. How did it come about? And who does it continue to exist for? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty and I'm delighted to be joined in studio today by Dr. Páirc Kerrigan, author of Reeling in the Queers, Tales of Ireland's LGBTQ Past. Well, first of all, what a title.
Thanks. It was there for the taking, so it hadn't been done. So I said, listen, I'm gonna take that and slap it on a book cover.
Like, sorry, it's 2026. We've had Reeling in the Ears for 40 years. How has nobody thought about this before now?
I know, it was insane. And I kind of went to myself, you know, this is also a really useful way to actually get people who aren't just in the lesbian and gay community and queer community more broadly. Reeling in the Ears is something we all know. It's something we all love. It was voted, I think, Ireland's most popular TV show back in, I think, 2015. So I said, let's take the name, apply to queer history, and let's maybe make it a bit more mainstream. And it has been successful so far, I think.
And I get that from the book, that you feel, you know, too much of queer history is queer history in those inverted commas. It's not just history, and it should be.
Yeah, because I mean, queer history, if you look at the last 50 years in Ireland, right, especially since independence in 1922, queer history is Irish history in the sense that it represents the best of us, right? It shows Ireland maturing from the shadows of the Catholic Church, from a theocracy, from conservatism. It represents the modernization of Ireland. And I think what the progression in queer rights represents also is that Irish people do often get tired of the brush of being conservative, but we're actually quite ahead of the institutions. I mean, people predicted that marriage equality, for example, in 2015, it would never happen. And then 63% of the population vote for it. Back to decriminalisation in 1993. It's never going to happen. No one will accept this. And people marched through the streets the next day for Gay Pride 1993, celebrating that it happened. So I think it's also the story of how Irish people are innately decent. And that's something to bear in mind right now when we have on one side of us across the Atlantic, lots of backsliding with an administration in the United States, and then across the Irish Sea in the UK, lots of backsliding and the potential of a reform government. Here in Ireland, around queer rights, not everything is perfect. It's not the Ireland I would absolutely love. It's not the optimism I had back in 2015. But the centre does seem to be holding somewhat here, I would say.
You talk about the shadows and you've talked about watching Pride in the past, right, from the edges of the city. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I think everyone has their own Pride journey. And I think everyone's individual story of Pride is representative of why it's so important. In the book, at the start of the chapter on the history of Irish Pride, I tell the story of John Calnan, and he's a young boy in Cork. He's 16. It's 1985. It's in the midst of homophobic murders. In one year, in 1982, four men are killed in homophobically charged attacks. It's in the midst of the AIDS pandemic, right? So it is not a good time to be gay, lesbian or queer. So John makes the brave step at the age of 17 to ring a helpline in Cork, and they start helping him and they say, come to Dublin Pride with us. So they travel up to Cork and he's nervous. He doesn't want to participate because what is Pride? It's a visible reclamation of public space. It's also you declaring yourself as visible. If you march in a Pride parade, you are affiliating yourself with the community and you're essentially coming out, be that as an ally or LGBT. So this was quite daunting for John and he said, you know what? I'm going to watch the parade from the edges. But that was not going to be the case. Those best laid plans were quickly overturned when someone in the Cork Gay Collective said, come here now, young fella, you're going to pull that other banner, the Cork Gay Collective banner, and you're going to march with us. John was terrified, but went, you know what? Screw it. Let's just do it. And he never felt more liberated. And when I talked to John for the book, I had the exact same experience myself. And we were speaking 40 years apart, by the way, where it kind of demonstrates these things don't go away. They are, everyone goes on a similar journey. My first Pride was back in 2011. I was in Maynooth University and I just went in from Maynooth one Saturday. I was working there over the summer and I watched it from the edges and I was too afraid to participate.
What age were you?
I was 19, 2011. And I mean, that's still a relatively good time. We've lots of good things happening. Brian Dowling has already won Big Brother. Anna Nolan's already been on. You know, queer visibility is happening. It's a nice moment. We're seeing far more mainstreaming of things. But even with that, I was still that little bit nervous. So like John Conlon in the book, and it just really resonated with me, I just walked along the edges. I wasn't ready to pick up a banner, to go in and declare myself, but it was really significant. Why? It was significant because there was thousands upon thousands of people who were marching down the streets of Dublin, and I went to myself, wow, they're well-adjusted, they're normal, they're fabulous, and they look like a lot of fun. And I went, I'm not ready just yet, but I know, because of Pride and coming into this to watch it from the edges, I know that community is there for me whenever I'm ready. And the subsequent year, oh, was I ready? And in I went.
And had you not come out yourself in 2011?
No, I'd not come out. That was a bit of a process for myself to kind of really kind of, I suppose, discover who I was, what I was. And I kind of had to, as we do, as we grow up in Ireland, we grow up in these nests that are heterosexual, and anything that is outside of that in the culture around us just is not, it's not normalized. So when you leave that nest, when you go to university, you go to work, when you leave school, you have to disentangle all of that to really start growing up. So my teenage years didn't really begin until I went to Maynooth at 2010. And that's a really liberal enclave, let me tell you, at the time. It's not called Gaynooth for a reason, right? I mean, it is...
Sorry, excuse me?
Yeah, Maynooth was, when I was going to university, known as Gaynooth. It had developed a really nice community and society, and it was also sort of seen as the safe university just on the cusp of the city. And I think that in and of its way, subconsciously, led a lot of people there, where they could kind of dip into the scene and come back out, but still feel the comforts of home, because it was quite a homely university at the time. So that was kind of the experience that I had. So going there, I started to, I suppose, have my teenage years in my 20s. And that's kind of was the slight delay. And I think that's the experience for many people. And that's also why Pride is so important, because it enables us to live out our teenage years.
And it's funny, the word safety comes up a lot, right? Actually. I picked up on that in the book. I think, though, for anybody listening to this podcast who is looking at you, listening to you talk and thinking, really, 2011? And you still didn't feel comfortable coming out? You didn't feel comfortable just joining a Pride parade and being part of this community? I think people are a bit shocked by that.
Yeah, but I mean, I'll shock you even more. It's still happening in 2026. We're 15 years later, and there will still be somebody like myself and John Callan, like Anna Nolan and Brian Dowling, who are my age at that time, and they will have the same fear, who will walk along the edges. And that is why Pride is so important and crucial. When you think you're in those liberal moments, be that 2011, when we're in the run-up to marriage equality, there's lots of really good, healthy conversations happening. You know, when I was coming of age, as it were, into my gay self, we were on the cusp of marriage equality. We didn't know if it was definitely going to happen, but there was a real significant visible push. And I remember lots of things happening on television. Orange is the New Black was coming out. Netflix had all of these fantastic forms of gay and lesbian representation. You couldn't move in the soap operas. I mean, I remember the storyline with Aaron Dingle in Emmerdale at the time. It was so crucial and so important for us in that era, before kind of streaming services took over. And even at that, you know, it doesn't, just because it's extremely visible, just because there's lots of legislation that's being implemented, doesn't necessarily mean that at the human level, it trickles down into making us feel like we're ready to do that. Mm. And that's a journey, and everyone has their own specific coming out journey. And I know it's a tale as old as time, that coming out story, but it is extremely individual. And I'm speaking to myself here from somebody in 2011 who got to relive their teenage years in their 20s. Oftentimes there's a community that's left out of this conversation, that is older people who don't ever come out for varying reasons, right? You might have somebody who has to maintain the farm in the west of Ireland. Now, I know it might be stereotypical here, but that is a reality for some people. You have somebody who got married and then just in their 40s and 50s went to themselves, Jesus, I grew up in an Ireland that was incredibly homophobic. I didn't have the tools to work out this is what I was, right? And they're in marriages that they might not be happy in. And there is a community out there who are older. And that's why Pride is also really important. It's kind of a message to them to say, we're here whenever you work your stuff out, and there is a community here for you to help you feel safe, as you say, Ciara, feel healthy, feel happy, and also feel a little bit of joy, because there's fun to be had here.
Who founded the movement in Ireland? How did it start?
That is a slightly complex question, but I'll give the cliff notes for you. So it kind of emerges.
Do a few people claim it.
A few people claim it. So we're heading into contested territory here.
I don't want to cause a rift in this community.
Well, we're not going to cause a rift. So I'm going to be as clear, simple and chronological as I can be. So the Stonewall riots happen in New York in 1969. Stonewall is not the first kind of big thing to happen in queer liberation, but essentially it is when the community rose against police raids in the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street in New York. It was being run by the Mafia, funnily enough. Fat Tony from The Simpsons is actually based on Fat Tony, who ran the Stonewall Inn. So there's a fun, useless fact for you all. But essentially, the community rose against the police raids. And it was the first time where there was palpable anger that really propelled the gay liberation movement forward. So this is the kind of real significant crash course. All of a sudden then, from 1969, gay liberation spreads in North America. It comes to Europe. In 1973, it comes to Ireland. In Northern Ireland, the new University of Coleraine controversially has been established. But people within the gay rights movement or active on sexual identity from the North and the Republic meet in the University of Coleraine and they say, right, it's criminalised in Northern Ireland and the Republic under the same laws, Victorian morality legislation, we need to be more visible. Let's go into our separate jurisdictions, set up our own groups, and from there, let's get a movement started. So in Northern Ireland, it's the Northern Irish Gay Rights Association, which is founded in 1974. And then in the Republic, we start with the Sexual Liberation Movement, which is a collective of men and women broadly around just gender and sexual rights. And then more specifically again, we come into 1974 when the Irish Gay Rights Movement is founded by a number of individuals, among which include people you would know, David Norris, but also other people who need to get their credit, Edmund Lynch, Martin Barnes, Clem Clancy, and Sean Connolly. And these very brave men come together to, in the most horrendous of circumstances, criminalisation. People are still being arrested for being with somebody on the street or meeting somebody, gay men primarily, because lesbian women couldn't be arrested because the law didn't even recognise that they existed. So 1974 is when it really kicks off in Ireland, and the Irish Gay Rights Movement sets up a space on Parnell Square at 46 Parnell Square near the Irish Writer Centre. The building still stands, and essentially becomes, they set up the Phoenix Club, and that is the first gay and lesbian social space in Ireland where people could actually for the first time go in and dance with somebody or have a first kiss and feel safe.
It's interesting, having researched this area before, I did come across this absolutely fascinating story that really stayed with me. I think it was Rathmines, and it was a member of An Garda Síochána who climbed over the bush to get into somebody's back garden to look in through the patio doors of somebody's ground floor apartment where they saw two gay men kissing. And based on that evidence, they were arrested.
Like, absolutely horrendous.
I just never forget that story. I thought, oh my God, how hostile was that environment? But one of the strengths of the books is that you want to introduce readers to people who have been largely forgotten. Which individual do you feel most deserved to be rescued from obscurity?
Oh, Ciara, that is a very bold question you're asking, because there's 14 stories, lots of people within those stories. And I suppose the one that really sticks with me would be Phil Moore. Because oftentimes in Pride season, people tend to ask, what does good allyship look like? And Phil Moore is the best representation of that. She was the mother of a gay son, Dermot Moore. He walked into her kitchen one morning. She was having, in her words, the most middle class of lunches, lentil soup and Guinness bread. And Dermot just says to her, "Mam, I need to speak to you." And so many mothers have had that moment where a child says that they want to share something. And I suppose I'm not a mother myself, I don't have a child myself, but I can only imagine their heart drops because they're about to say something. And he says, "Mam, I'm gay." And she responds kind of going, "Ah, listen to her, go away out of that, she'll grow out of that, she'll be grand. But in the days and the weeks and the months that followed, she said to herself, actually, that was the wrong thing to say to Dermot, because What he was actually asking me was, "Ma'am, will you still love me even though I'm gay?" And it was in that moment the penny dropped. And she said, "Right, I got to do something about this." So she said, "Dermot, show me your friends." So he brought her down to his friends. They were part of the National Gay Federation youth group. They met every Sunday in the Hirschfeld Centre at 10 Fowne Street. The Hirschfeld Centre was the second gay and lesbian community space that ran for 9 years. One of the most significant institutions in queer Irish history, might I add.
And this was the early 1980s for people. He was just 16.
Yeah. So we're talking 1983-84. And Phil goes in, meets all these 16 and 17-year-olds and talks to one fella who got the crap beaten out of him by his dad the night before and thrown out of the house. A young lesbian who was couch surfing around the city because her mom had kicked her out. And she said there's something rotten at the core of the Irish family that would do this to their children, that wouldn't necessarily bring them in to the family fold. So Phil said, "I'm not going to be active on gay and lesbian politics, but what I can do is I can reach out to parents. I can maybe convince parents that, no, if your child does come out, the sky is not going to collapse. Your world is not going to fall apart. Your child is not a degenerate. And if I can convince that and bring families back together, I can make my change that way." So she sets up an Irish chapter of Parents Inquiry. And essentially, she becomes like a doctor on call. Her phone is hopping off the wall. She's demanded around the country. She travels to Belfast. She travels to Cork, all with the purpose of meeting parents to tell them, one conversation at a time, your child is fine and you will be fine. And she repairs so many families together. And the reason why the story of Phil Moore, I think, is really important is because, I don't know, it might sound cheap to say, but simple conversations, like that was just her having a simple conversation, mother to mother, mother to father, and she changed the lives of mothers and gay sons and lesbian daughters. And that in is history making for me.
Hmm.
And that wouldn't get written into the traditional history books in our libraries in Trinity or UCD or Maynooth, but I think it should be. Because it doesn't change legislation, but it changes lives.
Mm.
And there's a real extraordinariness in just an ordinary mother.
Mm. Because being rejected by society is one thing. Being rejected by your mum
is another thing.
It's another thing. There was another really strong story, that of Tony Burgess.
Yes, Tony is also another personal hero of mine. And she is a fabulous individual. And it kind of reflects the fragility of the stories in marginalised communities. In that, if we don't record them, if we don't collect them, we lose them. In the case of Tony, I was unfamiliar that she even existed. A friend of mine from Cork said, it was Orla Egan, who runs the Cork LGBT archive. She said, "I think you should talk to Tony Burgess. I think she's ready to tell her story. She doesn't necessarily want to do like a big documentary or anything, but I think she'd like to be in a book and tell her story that way." So I rang Tony and she was game. And essentially, the context was Tony Burgess, like so many women of her age, married a man and then later in life realized she was a lesbian. But at the time, and she had two children, but at the time, if you came out as a lesbian, statistically, you would lose custody of your children. And oftentimes, many lesbian women would hand over custody of their children to their husbands, not out of want of not wanting to see their children, but because they didn't want to be publicly humiliated through the court system and being outed as a lesbian and then being ostracized by their communities. So essentially their backs were against the wall.
So they knew basically that if their husbands or ex-husbands took them to court, they were going to lose here.
Essentially, yeah. Because
and that was the environment that was likely to happen.
Lesbianism, essentially, in the eyes of the court, in 1970s and 1980s, Europe and America meant unfit mother. When in actual fact, we now know that that is not the case and it was never the case. So Tony does not take this sitting down and she fights to maintain custody of her children. And she goes through a process where she has limited custody in certain circumstances. And she's like, "No, that's absolutely unacceptable. I want full custody of my children. I want to maintain my relationship with my children and have full access." So she essentially sets about on a 2-year battle, jumping through hula hoops, barristers' fees, solicitors, to do what she can to have her life in such a way that the court system would deem her a respectable mother. And her story has a beautiful ending. After fighting with the tenacity, the resilience, and the sheer determination to do so, she ends up in Cove District Court 2 years after the original sort of arrangement being made. She arrives and the judge does deem her to be a fit mother. And her story has a beautiful ending. And she immediately leaves the courthouse and she goes to her children's school and she's a number of hours early, but she doesn't care. And she just waits the hours until they come out and they say, "Mammy, what are you doing here?" And she says, "You get to live with me now." And again, not necessarily a history-making moment, but for me it is, because that's what being human is all about. A mother wanting to just simply be with her children. And she becomes the first woman that we know of that successfully maintains custody of her children after leaving a marriage and coming out as a lesbian.
You talk about Ireland, you think we've stayed in the centre on these issues, right?
Ish, right?
And you talk about allyship a lot, but you will see a number of companies or corporations that are no longer aligning themselves with Pride. How do you feel about that?
I kind of feel like...
And the pushback that is here in Ireland too. Okay, it's not the States, but it definitely exists. And a lot of people very, very uncomfortable, perhaps, with the direction they felt Ireland was heading in.
I mean, look at it this way. It is sort of a reflection of what's happening on both sides of Ireland right now. We're an island nation, US here, the UK here. The lack of corporations that are sponsoring Pride and the decrease that we've seen in that is a trickle down from the policies of the US president, essentially, and a diktat from EDI being removed from all US government policies. Just look at Ireland. You know, we have the Silicon Docks. How many tech companies do we have here? So that has been a trickle down of a regime in the US. And what does that actually say about Pride? I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. At some points, the corporations and Pride felt a little bit like pinkwashing to a degree, in that it was trendy, modern, exuberant, nice to be affiliated with the LGBT community, because the window of liberation was open for us in the 2015s, right? And again, as I said at the start, marriage equality kind of brought a sense of optimism that, yeah, we're all on board with this. And it kind of just goes to show that they're fair weather friends, really, doesn't it? Because it demonstrates that when the winds are blowing against us, they're happy to pull the ships away. And I think it is a good thing to a degree, because it has really reified what Pride is all about. It is a protest. It is fun, it's joyous, but within the protest, you can have some celebrations. And it's reminded us that Pride is also, crucially, about community. And again, there are some good corporations that do sponsor Pride, that do really good things for the community and really take it seriously and kind of go to themselves, okay, well, what does sponsorship look like? So I do want to kind of put that caveat out there. But in the same breath, I think the removal of some of the corporations and the money going into it has reflected the community-orientated nature of what it all was when Stonewall began and when Ireland's Pride movement really took off in 1983. It was about making ourselves visible for a day, demonstrating that we exist. And perhaps we did lose a little bit of sight of what Pride was in that kind of 2010s era, where it was for the person like myself or John Callanan along the edges of the parade, afraid to participate. And I think now we can perhaps emphasise that aspect a little bit more, along with ensuring that Ireland does not backslide, does not follow our UK, our US and European counterparts into regression. Because these rights, while we have them, are not permanent, can be repealed, it can regress. And we need Pride to ensure that that does not happen. And also, again, I say these things, I don't want to be too glib or grim, but also, crucially, while it is a protest, it is community orientated, it's also fun. And we have to remember that in the protest and the party, that we have fun as well.
Well, I hope you have a fun weekend.
I hope you will as well. Come on in.
Dr. Pádraig Carrigan, Reeling in the Queers is the name of the book. Thank you so much for joining us, News Talk Daily, today.
Thank you, Kira.
That's it from us today on News Talk Daily. Have a fabulous weekend. Enjoy Pride. Enjoy the sunshine. We'll be back on Monday morning. Take care. Bye-bye.